Diversity is a booming business. Organizations across the country are turning to diversity and inclusion initiatives, or D&Is, to chip away at inequity in the workplace. And they're spending billions of dollars on everything from commissioning studies and task forces to recruiting consultants to hold anti-bias trainings. And many companies are also creating new roles tasked with improving diversity, like chief diversity officers. In 2018, the job site Indeed reported that online job postings for diversity and inclusion professionals had increased 35% since 2016. But while the business of diversity is growing, diversity itself is not. Many groups remain underrepresented across industries and particularly in leadership positions. And joining me now to talk through the scope and the limits of diversity in the business of it is Pamela Newkirk, journalist and author of the new book, Diversity, Inc., The Failed Promise of a Billion-Dollar Business. Pamela, thanks for being with us.
Such a pleasure.
So let's start with the basics. We hear a lot about diversity. We hear a lot about inclusion. They're not the same thing. What is the difference between the two?
Well, diversity is having, I guess, representation of different groups in the workplace. Inclusion is making them feel like they belong to those institutions.
Two very different things. I want to get into how those kind of, you know, shake out.
Right.
Now, we mentioned a lot about diversity initiatives. We're seeing it's this billion-dollar industry. But why are we seeing so much money invested in this right now?
Well, that was the question that led me to my book. I wanted to look at this tension between the rhetoric around diversity and the billions of dollars that are spent and the fact that the numbers are not substantially changing, particularly in many of our most elite fields. I'm thinking academia, law, museums, the arts in general, Hollywood. So why are we investing so much to get so little?
And so why are we? I mean, are companies just feeling like they have to do this now? Are they feeling like, okay, we've got to check this box in order to look like we're doing something?
Right. Well, I really can't get into the heads of the institution leaders who are doing this, but when you keep doing the same thing and expect different results, then maybe you need to step back and interrogate what it is that you're doing.
So let's talk about the goal here. I mean, we mentioned all types of things that companies are doing. They're bias training. They're, you know, trying to make more efforts to change. Are we talking about optics, Pamela? Or are we talking about real change? And what I mean by real change is hiring people into senior positions,
right?
Or are we just talking about covering the company?
Well, it does appear in many instances companies seem more concerned about the public relations around diversity than social justice. We do see that when there are embarrassing missteps or revelations of exclusion, homogenous workplaces or boards, that's when we all of a sudden see these high-profile initiatives. And then if you check in a year or two later, you haven't really seen much activity in the numbers, you know. So I'm focusing on the actual metrics, and they're just not moving.
So oftentimes we say, you know, one of the things that a lot of folks, when they talk about diversity in the workplace in particular, is that we say it's good for business,
right?
But I want to unpack that a little, because that also feels like a double-edged sword.
Yes.
I mean, it feels like, you know, should we be valuing quote-unquote diverse employees just because they're, you know, good for the bottom line? And are we doing that for non-diverse employees? Like, how does that really play out?
Right. I think there was a period during which the bottom line argument was made because nothing else was working.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this theory, if you tell companies that it's going to help your bottom line, and it may indeed do that, that there would at least be that economic incentive to achieve diversity, but not even that has worked in many instances. But the good news is that there are models. There are models that companies can replicate. You don't have to recreate the wheel to make this work. Diversity, it requires intention. But it also, in goodwill. I mean, you have to really be serious about this thing. I interviewed Columbia University President Lee Bollinger, and as he says, this doesn't happen by accident. It happens because you lean into it. And it's not something that you can just do by fiat. I mean, it takes it takes a lot of unpacking, as you say, because it's a multi-layered problem.
So let's talk about that, because I was tweeting about this the other day, and one of the things I said that got a lot of attention was, you know, don't tell particularly journalists of color that you're hiring them or us because you need to diversify.
Precisely.
But then how do you do it, right? Because there's a balance between making someone feel like they've only been hired
right.
because the company or the organization wants to fulfill its diversity mission.
Right.
And then not doing it. So what? How do you
exactly.
balance that?
Well, that's the lack of goodwill. That's doing it for a reason other than just equity, inclusion, justice. What's, you know, do we live in a fair society or not? Are we excluding people because of their race? Or are we including people because we want to be smarter? We want that insight that only can come from having that kind of diverse operation. And I think what often happens is it's viewed as a check a box, you know, we'll get this person in. And then that triggers resentment in the newsroom because, oh, you got your job because why'd you get your job? And so there's always this suspicion around hiring people of color. And this taps into centuries of demeaning stereotypes about people of color. It taps into a well of what it means to live in to be in an institution that is excellent. What does excellence look like?
And also the idea that, you know, we're only here because, you know, we have to be here because some optics are necessary or,
right.
you know, we're here on some charity
initiative. Not because it makes us smarter,
right.
because it makes us better.
Or not because we're smarter and better.
Precisely.
Right? And so is there, I mean, we've got less than a minute left. Is there anything that can be done, do you think?
Well, one of the chapters that I deal with in the book is looking at Coca-Cola and how over 5 years it really focused on this issue after, of course, it was sued for discrimination and it settled a landmark bias lawsuit. And what they did is they examined the metrics across the workplace. They looked at job categories. They looked at salaries, bonuses, who was being hired, what did the candidate pool look like. And over time, they were able to both detect and disrupt patterns of disparities, patterns of bias.
Pamela Newkirk is a journalist and the author of Diversity, Inc., The Failed Promise of a Billion-Dollar Business. Pamela, thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking about the explosion of diversity initiatives in the workplace, which includes the addition of positions like chief diversity officers.
The chief diversity officer is so marginalized and not really in the main of the company, and it's like, okay, that person is responsible for diversity. It's like, no, everyone should be responsible for diversity, you know, up to the highest in leadership.
That's Pamela Newkirk, who we just spoke to, and she's the author of the new book, Diversity, Inc. And as she told us, many of these new positions and initiatives are failing to make any real impact. And I've been thinking a lot about this and about how putting someone in a role like head of diversity and inclusion can almost seem to give companies a way out of the harder work they need to prioritize diversity. So I turn next to two experts who study this very thing. Veronica Ribello is an assistant professor at San Francisco State University, and Courtney McClooney is a postdoctoral fellow at the Darden School of Business. And I put my concerns to Veronica.
So I certainly share your concern, because I don't think that these roles are a panacea in and of themselves. People's effectiveness depends a lot on the resources they're provided to do this work once they are appointed as chief diversity officers. So we do know that people in these positions are a lot more effective when they do have buy-in from leaders in the organization, when leaders have taken efforts to really prepare the other members of the organization to embrace and prepare for change, because any kind of broad change in organizations requires preparation and buy-in. So although there's not a ton of research in this area, Courtney and I both worry about the effectiveness of diversity officers, just given the limited resources a lot of them are given to do their work. And by resources, we mean a budget to do their work, time, people power in terms of a team, knowledge and prior experience. Do these diversity officers have prior experience in leading or managing organizational change or creating or testing different strategies? And then finally, information. There's some articles out there suggesting that sometimes chief diversity officers don't even have access to internal company data that would allow them to kind of identify where there might be problems as well as opportunities for intervention.
Courtney, a lot of times it goes beyond the diversity and inclusion officer. It's you know, doing a lot of promotion, but there isn't a lot of institutional support. It sometimes feels like it's more about the optics for companies than it is about structural change. Do you find that?
Yes, that's exactly the point I was just going to add in. So two of my mentors, Dean Lynn Wooten at the Dyson School of Economics at Cornell University and Dean Erica James of Emory's Guazzetta School of Business at Emory University, they have done a lot of historic data showing that the appointment of chief diversity officers or even sort of this task force associated with diversity and inclusion within companies tends to come about after what they call a diversity crisis. So after there has been a very wide public scandal within the organization, whether they're involved in like a racial harassment lawsuit, sexual harassment lawsuit, or if there's been larger pushback from social movements, for example, that this company has been discriminatory towards customers, that is usually when the appointment of the officer comes about. So this both serves, as you said, as more of a window dressing, reputation saving move. And it would suggest that it's also very reactionary, that the company itself does not have this larger institutional strategic desire to create a diverse and inclusive organization. But it's more, again, going back to the compliance reasons of why we have Title VII and controlling how we're hiring and promoting people.
So let's talk about solutions real quick. From each of you, Courtney and Veronica, what should companies be doing better so that these are programs are actually having some sort of an impact on the bottom line here?
So one of the things that happened this past year was Starbucks closed down a lot of their stores in North America to do one-day-long diversity training in response to the two Black men in the Philadelphia Starbucks location being arrested for loitering. And although it was a bold move to suggest that we would rather lose revenue for a day to talk about this important issue, there was a lot of critiques on how one-day training is not sufficient because, as Veronica was stating earlier, issues around diversity, equity, inclusion are built within the broader ecosystem. So it's not just how you're treating people on a day-to-day basis, but what is our larger overarching company model and how can we make this an ongoing progressive strategy, which is what activists who are calling for more equitable practices in companies that go beyond diversity and inclusion are also calling for, a recognition that there has been past wrongs historically at a systemic level to certain groups and making constant adjustment to how they're doing their work and going about it. So that it can become an ongoing type of training and not something that just happens one time so people can check the box. So I would suggest that one thing companies can do is to really think more strategically and systemically about incorporating diversity, equity, and inclusion training.
Agreed completely. I don't think it's possible for organizations to identify a single training or a single intervention that's going to solve problems that really have been building for hundreds of years since the foundation of this country. So promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion in a genuine, sustained way is going to require multi-pronged approaches, sustained efforts, significant amount of time. So it really does need to be embedded within the wider organizational ecosystem. So thinking about how leaders are recruiting, interviewing, and hiring new employees, training, developing, and promoting their existing employees, as well as compensating, incentivizing, and promoting them. So I think one starting point for organizations is to actually collect and analyze data, trying to identify where they might have achieved parity and where there might be disparities. I think it's also really important that these data are intersectional. That is, we're looking at the experiences of multiple identity groups simultaneously. So, for example, if we're just analyzing company data to see if there's a gender pay gap, that could lead us to overlook potential pay gaps within the category of women, say white women versus Black and Latino women. So I think it's really important that companies start to collect and analyze their internal data and develop strategies and interventions accordingly.
Veronica Ribello is an assistant professor at San Francisco State University, and Courtney McClooney is a postdoctoral fellow at the Darden School of Business. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton. or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.